The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
We move on now to the second major section of the outline. Usually when I would ask a question of Dr. Van Til, he'd say, let's go back to the Garden of Eden, but every now and then he'd say, let's go back to Thales. Thales being, of course, the first of the Greek philosophers that we know about. So I have here a kind of summary history of epistemology so that you can see a little bit where DKG fits in to the larger currents of the history of philosophy. Now, this is obviously not going to be a complete history of philosophy, nor is it even a complete epistemology. Essentially, I'm focusing on a few themes in the history of epistemology that have played a major role in my own thinking, especially as it's developed the book that you'll be reading. I'm interested in Dr. Van Til's rationalist-irrationalist dialectic, which I mentioned briefly in comparison with Adam and Eve a while ago. I'm interested in the this relationship, which we briefly alluded to, between the subject and the object, which has been a major concern in epistemology through the history of the discussion. And I would add to that not only subject and object, but also a third element, namely the element of the criterion or the norm, so that you have not only the subject and the object, but the norm to contend with, and how those three elements are related to one another. And then I'm interested in the historical relationships between rationalism and empiricism. Now, I mentioned to you a little bit ago a contrast between rationalism and irrationalism. That's using the term rationalism in a fairly broad sense. But when I distinguish between rationalism and empiricism, I'm using the term rationalism in a somewhat narrower sense. That is to designate a particular tradition within the history of philosophy. Of course, in Dr. Van Til's view, all non-Christian philosophers are rationalists in the broad sense, and all non-Christian philosophers are rationalists, are irrationalists in the broad sense. But in the narrower sense, there's a specific tradition that's known as rationalism, and I want to say a few things about that specific tradition and how it relates to other specific traditions, particularly empiricism and idealism. We want also to see a little bit as to how these thinkers draw the relationship between the practical and the theoretical. That has become a very important distinction, particularly in the modern period of the history of philosophy. And then I also would like to show you in general how these non-Christian views of epistemology tend to break down. That is, how they tend to display their own inadequacy. And we'll see that in contrast with a Christian position, which I think helps us to remedy the problems which exist in the various non-Christian systems. Well, philosophy begins, at least this is the way the textbooks put it. Dr. Van Til would say philosophy began at the Garden of Eden, but in most of the textbooks you'll read that philosophy begins, or at least Western philosophy. Now, of course, we can't deal with Oriental philosophy, which is a whole other thing. But Western philosophy begins in ancient Greece with these early nature philosophers such as Thales, Anaximander, Anaximenes, and so on. Thales was the guy who said all is water, right? We don't know very much about Thales. Thales didn't leave any books behind, and all we know basically is what we hear from other people, especially Aristotle. So don't take too seriously anything you may hear about these early people. We really don't know very much about them. We don't know what Thales, if Thales really said all is water, and if he did, exactly what did he mean by it? He may have looked outside his back window once after a very stormy day and said, oh my, all is water. And people, you know, his adoring students took out their notebooks and wrote it all down and meditated on that until it turned into something very different from what he meant originally. But anyway, what's important to us is not what Thales really meant, but rather how Thales' words have been used in the history of philosophy. What significance have they had for other philosophers? How have they influenced others, either positively or negatively? Now, as far as we know about Thales, we don't have any explicit reflection on epistemology, theory of knowledge, from him. We do have, I think, reason to believe that these early philosophers were seeking a more secular way of understanding the world from the traditional Greek religions. One good source for this, I think, is Duivird's book In the Twilight of Western Thought, where he discusses the ancient philosophers and shows that, in a way, they were secularizing some of the religious notions of their time, some of the notions that existed in the popular religions. But they were rejecting those popular religions in favor of a more secular and, in their mind, a more rational, a more intellectual way of understanding the world. And there you can see some echo of what Dr. Van Til calls rationalism, that is, a tendency to try to find a more autonomous way of thinking, to escape from authority. Now, from our point of view, of course, the authorities of the ancient Greek religions weren't worth anything as authorities. But the secular philosophers didn't even want those authorities. They wanted no authority. They wanted to be their own authority. They wanted to be autonomous. And so we find there the rationalistic motive. The interesting thing is, of course, that these early thinkers saw as their duty, their philosophical duty, reducing all of reality to a single element, to a single kind of substance. Now, you know that they generally acknowledged that there were four elements, earth, air, fire, and water. Aristotle thought he had discovered a fifth one, but anyway, there are at least four. And they posed the question of which one of these is the most basic element, which of these is the most fundamental element. And Anaximenes said that all is air. Heraclitus said, in effect, that all is fire. Anaximander said, no, it's none of these four. It's rather something called the indefinite, the apeiron, in which all of these elements are mixed together in some way, in which they come apart through various processes. For Thales said that, according to Aristotle, said that all is water. What's going on there? Well, first of all, notice the all is. The all is erases the creator-creature distinction, doesn't it? If you believe that everything is water, then you believe that both God, if he exists, and creatures, assuming that they exist, are both water, both made of the same stuff, both having the same status. Yes, sir? Well, yeah, I think you can say that they weren't conscious of reducing the creator as we know him to something less than he is. That's certainly true, and it's important, I think, to keep in mind what they were conscious of and what they weren't conscious of. At the same time, I think that they were looking for a comprehensive principle, you know. I don't think they would have allowed any, here again we're talking about something we don't really know much about, but to use a term like all generally implies that you have everything in view and that you're not going to tolerate any exceptions to that. And so I do think it is proper to say that should there be any God, such as the Bible describes, Thales' philosophy would have to be very sharply modified to accommodate him. I mean, Thales would have to admit that his all doesn't deal with quite all that there is. It would have to undergo drastic revision, that he's really missed what's most important about the universe. And I think that the basic point still holds. Yeah.
Do you think they meant to include the human being or the human soul in that reduction?
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. They're trying, among other things, to show where man came from, where man's mind, how man's mind has developed, what we are. And that's what I get to here under number four. If all is reduced to water and air and so on, then human thought, too, is reduced to water or air or whatever it may be. And if that is the case, then how do we account for its validity? How can one puff of air be more valid than another puff of air? How can one wave of the sea be more valid than another wave of the sea? If you reduce thought to simply mechanical, materialistic cause and effect, then you really have eliminated the possibility of accounting for the validity of thought. So you have a rationalistic approach trying to eliminate religious authority, trying to bring the divine mind down to the same level as ours, or similarly to raise ours to the same level as the divine mind. And then you have what amounts to irrationalism, in that the mind just can't function this way. Unless the mind is somehow transcendent, somehow distinct from this general explanation, then of course you don't have any way of accounting for thought at all. So you have a very irrationalistic tendency here, and you can see at the very beginning of the history of epistemology both the rationalistic motive and the irrationalistic motive. Parmenides represents perhaps the most consistent rationalist that there has ever been in the history of philosophy, and he comes up with a slogan which has been repeated with variations many times through the history of thought. He says, what can be and what can be thought are one. What does that mean exactly? Again, it's hard to say. We don't have a lot of stuff that comes from Parmenides, although we have quite a bit more than we have from Thales. What can be and what can be thought are one. Your first impression you get from that statement is the idea that every thought that I have, at least every valid thought, must be correlated perfectly, must tie in perfectly with some element of reality. That means my thought of the table must perfectly represent that table. It must be a perfect representation of the table. My thought of the clock must be a perfect representation of the clock. That is the goal of the rationalist, to have perfection in thinking, to have no discrepancy between what's in the mind and what's in reality. But, if you think about that a little bit more, you come to what is perhaps a more profound interpretation of the statement of Parmenides, and it has been used in this more profound way by other philosophers like Spinoza and Hegel. That is that what can be thought, okay, what can be and what can be thought are very literally the same thing, all right? Very literally the same thing. Imagine I have a thought of the clock. There's the clock, there's my thought. My thought may be a perfect representation, but there's still a division there. There's still a discrepancy because although my thought corresponds perfectly with the clock, my thought is not the clock, okay? There's something different. There's a difference between the thought and the clock. And to the rationalist, the idea of a difference is intolerable. The idea of there being a difference between the thought and the reality is something that the rationalist cannot tolerate. And so rationalists tend to be monists. That is to say, rationalists tend to be people who think that the whole universe consists of one thing, that there really is no difference between the mind and the clock. There's no difference between the mind and the table. And that means there's no difference between the table and the clock. And there's no difference between the table and the tree outside. And there's no difference between this classroom and the people in the classroom. And so that there's really, in the final analysis, only one thing in the universe. Parmenides, I think, went pretty close, at least when Parmenides spells out his metaphysics in detail. It turns out that he is a monist, and whether he used the argument that I've just drawn out, I'm not sure. Parmenides is one who believes that the world is essentially one thing. Another way of putting this, number two, is that he is eliminating everything from the world which he believes cannot be accounted for rationally. And if there's something you see that bothers the mind, something that the mind can't quite handle, then you see Parmenides eliminates that from the world. There can be nothing in the world which the mind is incapable of handling. And so change, for instance, if things change, something changes from one state to another, well, Parmenides had a hard time with that. You might not think that's such a hard thing to conceptualize, but for Parmenides it was. Here you have something that turns into something else. And that change, where does that come from? Not from the original thing, it seems to come from nowhere. This one object mysteriously changes from its present state into something else. Where does that change come from? Where does that power to change come from? The mind pictures the first object, and you can't picture in that object any power of change. Parmenides took the easy way out here. He said, there is no change. There is no change. Everything is constant. Everything remains the same all the time. What about motion? Well, there can't be any motion either, because motion's a form of change. What about plurality? Well, again, he thought, if the mind is going to be dependable, there can be no plurality. The mind works by absorbing pluralities into unities, by bringing all the little puppies under the label dog, by bringing all the individual chairs under the label chair. So there can be nothing, there can be no plurality in the world as such. So these are all excluded from the universe. These are all illusions. In Parmenides' world, there is no change, there is no motion, there is no plurality, there is no non-being. However, there's a problem with this, and that is, if you're really going to be a rationalist, there shouldn't be any illusions in the world. You shouldn't be subject to illusions. There should be no problems of that sort. And so Parmenides really finds himself in a bind at this point. On the one hand, he's tried to develop a view of the world in which the mind is thoroughly competent, in which the mind is able to gain an exhaustive and perfect knowledge of everything. But in formulating this view of the world, he comes up with a view of the world in which almost everything we experience is an illusion, in which we're constantly being deceived all the time. And that's not a very good position for a rationalist to be in. And so Parmenides, in effect, admits to failure. I say in effect he admits to failure. What he does is he says that you really need a second philosophy to deal with the world of illusion. Parmenides' philosophy will not really help us much in the world in which we live. We need a second philosophy which helps us to get along in this world of illusions. And in the world of illusions, we need to believe not only is there one principle, as in Parmenides' major philosophy, but there are two principles that are constantly at war with one another. Well, you see how Parmenides the rationalist becomes an irrationalist as the implications of his philosophy are worked out. Starts off trying to maintain that the mind is fully competent, able to maintain exhaustive knowledge, winds up in his conclusion believing that the mind is constantly deceived and needs an actual mythology in order to carry on its work in the world. Did you have a question? Yeah.
By deception, he is brought to man.
Oh yes, yeah. It's simply anything that appears to be what it's not. And Parmenides doesn't have the idea that there's some personal deceiver out there deceiving us. He simply says that the world is, arranged in such a crazy way that our minds are constantly deceived as to what is. Heraclitus now comes along, takes the opposite position from Parmenides. Parmenides said nothing changes. Heraclitus says everything changes. Heraclitus begins as an irrationalist, we might say. Put an AL in that word in quotes there. Heraclitus begins as an irrationalist. But he realizes, too, that you can't construct a philosophy based on irrationalism. You can't, if you just say everything is constantly changing into everything else, then you don't have even the ability to attach names to things. You know, if this table is changing into a tiger and the tiger is changing into a balloon and so on and so forth, and if this is happening constantly and this is happening rapidly, then reality is not stable enough even to attach names to things, and therefore we can't really do philosophy at all. We can't really describe the world at all. So there has to be some constancy. There has to be some constant element. That's was Parmenides' point, and Heraclitus himself came to realize the validity of this. And so Heraclitus included as part of his philosophy the idea of a logos. You Greek scholars, this is the first appearance of the term logos in the history of philosophy. And the logos is, for Heraclitus, the pattern of change, the rational principle in the universe that keeps things changing in an orderly way. That orderly pattern, of course, is something that doesn't change itself, because so it has to be an exception to the overall theory of Heraclitus. Well, you see how Heraclitus's irrationalism doesn't work out, and so almost arbitrarily he has to import a rationalistic principle in order to get the universe to slow down long enough for him to make an account of it. Then we have the philosophical atomists. They represent a rationalist alternative to Parmenides. Parmenides believed that there was only one thing in the world. Parmenides was a monist. He believed that there was only one reality. The atomists believe that there are many realities. They're pluralists. And they try to, but they have a motive very similar to Parmenides. Parmenides wants to find an absolute, exhaustive, intellectual account of the world. The atomists, the same. They want to find an absolute, unexceptionable account of the world. Parmenides does it by turning everything into one, crushing all the distinctions in the world, making everything into one. The atomists try to find the ultimate constituents of reality. That means you have to chop everything up and come up with the ultimate parts. So that if I chop this table up, I get at first four legs and a flat board, and then I cut the flat board up and I get parts of that and parts of those and parts of those, and pretty soon I get down to something which in the minds of the atomists, something which couldn't be broken, namely atoms. And the atoms then form the ultimate constituents of the world. And once you've got those, you've got everything. Well, so you have the rationalist project, but there's a certain amount of irrationalism in this too. For one thing, the atomists are materialists, and so the human mind is reduced to matter, reduced to the motions of these atoms as they move around in the world. As a matter of fact, they spoke, at least from the time of Epicurus, they spoke of the atom swerving with no reason for the swerve at all. Here you have the atoms going down, most of them falling vertically. But, you know, if all the atoms in the world are falling vertically, then they'll never knock into one another, will they? Because they're all going on a perfectly vertical course. And if they never hit one another, they never strike one another, then they'll never form objects. They'll never form tables or chairs or trees or whatever. So, according to Epicurus, what happens is that you know, they're falling down on the vertical, in these vertical courses, and every now and then one of them will swerve, veer from the vertical, and bounce against another one, and that's what starts the whole formation of the earth and so on and so forth. Totally irrational event. It just happens. There's no cause for it. It's just pure chance that goes into that. And therefore, you have, in order to account for the deficiencies then in the atomistic scheme, the rationalism has to be supplemented by an irrationalism, supplemented by this element of pure chance. Then we have the sophists who begin with an irrationalism, saying that everything is relative, there is no absolute truth, there's no objective truth, there's only truth for me. These are the people that you run into on college campuses all the time, people who've had an introductory course to philosophy, you know, and they come away saying, all is relative, there is no absolute truth, and blah, blah, blah. And classical response to that, which goes back to Plato, is to say, well, what about the statement that you just made, that there is no absolute truth? Is that absolutely true? And if he says, no, that's not absolutely true, then you ask, well, why did you say it? And if he says, yes, it is absolutely true, that there is no absolute truth, then he's contradicted himself, of course, and you can go on to something else. Anyway, the sophists said that there's no absolute truth, but then they turned around and made all kinds of very dogmatic statements, which is typical of relativists. After they've made their epistemological point that there is no absolute truth, and they'll turn around and say all kinds of things very dogmatically. Marxists are typical here. They, you know, on the one hand, they'll say there's no truth except truth for one's class, or truth for the bourgeois, truth for the proletariat, and so on and so forth. And they'll turn around and say all kinds of things very dogmatically. And in other words, supplementing their irrationalism with rationalism. Plato seeks to avoid this kind of problem. That way you get a little bit of both in there. Plato, of course, distinguished between the world of forms and the world of experience. Basically, this is where we all live. And, of course, in our experience, our main project is to try to understand this world in which we're living. How do we gain any kind of understanding of it? Well, somehow, in our experience, we come in contact with we get in our minds certain concepts that enable us to put the world together, that enable us to get some structure, some organization into the world. For instance, we have we discover in our minds the concept of a triangle. Okay, all of us have in our minds the concept triangle. Now, where do we get that concept of triangle? Some people might say, well, you get it through seeing three-sided objects. No, every three-sided object that you have seen is something less than a perfect triangle. You've never seen a perfect triangle. You've never seen a triangle with perfectly straight edges, one that adds where the angles add up to precisely 180 degrees, one that perfectly fits all the mathematical geometrical formulas that you've learned in high school. So where did you get this concept of a perfect triangle? Not from experience. Well, Plato says that if there's no perfect triangle here on Earth, there must be a perfect triangle somewhere else. A form of a triangle, an idea of a triangle, he says. And that perfect triangle then is the sort of the standard or the criterion for all the triangles that we experience here in this world. We judge a three-sided object here by how it measures up to that three-sided object which exists in the world of forms, or the world of standards, the world of criteria. Now, how do we know these? How do we get up here and know these? Well, Plato said at one time, before we were born, all of us lived in the world of forms, and we had some experience of these objects, and we happen to remember this when we come down to Earth. Unfortunately, this is his version of the fall. We all have come down to Earth, away from this heaven where the forms exist, and now we're down here. We don't see these things anymore, but we remember them, and we're able to use this knowledge in order to understand the things in our own experience. Not only is there a perfect triangle up here, but there's a perfect man, all right? Perfect tree, perfect, you see everything. People would ask Plato, well, what about mud, hair, and filth? Are there forms of mud, hair, and filth? And on the one hand, Plato would want to say, yes, there are forms of everything, because there has to be a form in order to explain what we have down here. Now, obviously, there's mud, hair, and filth in the world, so there have to be forms up there in order to explain the mud, hair, and filth down here in the world. On the other hand, forms are supposed to be perfect, okay? Forms are supposed to be ideal. And so Plato didn't know quite what to do with that. He never came up with an answer, I think, that thoroughly satisfied him, kind of his own version of the problem of evil, you might say. But anyway, that's the way he did it. And so the forms, number one there under F, the forms represent the rationalism of Parmenides. The forms are supremely knowable. They're perfectly knowable, perfectly rational. They are stable. They don't change. They don't grow. They don't move around. This is exactly like Parmenides' universe, except that there are many forms. Parmenides believed there is only one object in the world. Plato says there are many forms. But all of these forms, of course, themselves are reducible to higher forms, and at the top of this hierarchy you get something called the form of the good. So even here, see, Plato is reducing all the pluralities that he's familiar with to one form, ultimately. But anyway, these forms make knowledge possible, and that's the rationalistic side of Plato. But what about this world down here? This world down here is full of imperfections. This world down here is full of change, full of plurality, full of all those things that Parmenides couldn't explain. So what do we do with this world down here? How do these perfectly unchanging objects explain all of the change, all of the movement that exists down here in this world? How do the forms explain what is not formal? The forms are supposed to explain everything, but the forms don't explain change. The forms don't explain plurality. The forms don't explain imperfection. The forms, remember, is problems with mud, hair, and filth. They don't explain what is ignoble, what is unworthy. Okay? And so in this way, Plato becomes has to add to his rationalism a certain amount of irrationalism. Basically, the way he explains it is that it's like a sculptor. You know, a sculptor tries his best to make a copy of his model. His model is standing there. He's got the clay, and he's working with it. He's trying to make a copy of this person, but he may do a very good job. But the one thing he'll never do is to make another person, because the clay is not going to is not the right medium. The clay will resist his efforts to make a perfect copy, to make another person. And so similarly here, it's like this is the clay and this is the model, and the clay can never perfectly represent what's up here. Well, it's a nice story, and Plato almost represents it as a myth. This is his dialogue called the Timaeus. He almost represents it as a myth. But, you know, if this is really the way things happen, then how do you account for the differences between this world and this world? You can't account for them by referring to forms. How do you account for them? The forms are supposed to account for everything. But now we've seen the forms don't account for everything. The forms don't account for imperfection. They don't account for the differences between this world and this world. And so really, the forms don't do their job. The forms don't explain what they're supposed to explain. The forms don't completely explain anything at all. And so the theory of the forms really fails to accomplish its rationalistic purpose. Plato has to inject some irrationalism in with his rationalism in order to accomplish his purpose. Number three, top of page three, he recognizes the need for knowledge that does not come from sense experience. He recognizes that we need a kind of knowledge that does not come from what we see, what we hear, and so on. A knowledge that can be called a priori. That's a phrase which means this is knowledge that we bring to our sense experience rather than knowledge which we derive from our sense experience. A priori knowledge. Now, this is typical of rationalists who emphasize that we can't make anything out of sense experience unless we bring criteria to bear on it. And this is the positive thing that I like in Plato, that Plato recognizes that we not only need a subject and an object, somebody knowing and an object to know, but we also need a standard. We also need a criterion. We need some kind of a norm. And that, I think, is the strong point of Plato's theory, and it's a necessary point in any epistemology. But, of course, the way Plato does it, it doesn't accomplish the purpose that it should. Under Aristotle, you have the same problem, essentially, with form and matter. I'm not going to go into him in detail. Those of you who know the history of philosophy, I think, can adapt the same critique to Aristotle's work. Aristotle is more of an empiricist. An empiricist is somebody who believes that knowledge comes through the senses. Knowledge comes through what we see and hear. Essentially, Plato is not an empiricist. Plato says that our knowledge comes through this past reflection, past memory, not through our present sensations. Aristotle is more of an empiricist. He gives a better role to our sense experience, but he too recognizes the need for unprovable first principles and for what he calls the active intellect, that is, the mind arranging the sense experiences. The mind, see your eyes take in certain data. Your mind works with that. Your mind processes all of those things in order to put it into an intelligible, understandable shape. Aristotle has made some advances over Plato. The idea of the active intellect, I think, is a real major contribution that Aristotle makes, although I think that he's still subject to the same problem of the rationalist-irrationalist dialectic that we find in Plato. Plotinus, of course, now we're jumping ahead quite a number of centuries. Aristotle, 4th century B.C., Plotinus, 3rd century A.D. Plotinus starts off very rationalistically. He seeks a rational account of everything, including those elements in the world which Plato and Aristotle thought were irrational. He wants, in other words, to amend this problem. He wants to be able to make sense of this world, make sense of change, make sense of plurality, make sense of imperfection, make sense of all these things that Plato was unable to make sense out of. He uses a rationalist slogan rather similar to that of Parmenides. Parmenides, you remember, said that it's the what can be thought and what can be are really the same. Plotinus says, intelligence is the first legislator, or rather, it is the very law of existence. Parmenides, therefore, was right in saying that thought is identical with existence. The knowledge of immaterial things is therefore identical with those things themselves. And there, I think you have a cue to what Plotinus is up to. Plotinus starts with a first principle, which he calls the One. He calls it the One, but we have to put that in quotes, because what is the One? Well, the One is not powerful, because it's the source of power. It's the explanation of power. The One is not merciful, because it's the source of mercy. It's the explanation of mercy. It's the principle underlying mercy. The One is not even one. It's not many, because it's the principle underlying manyness. It's the principle underlying plurality. But it's not one either, because it's the principle underlying oneness. You see what Plotinus is doing? He's saying we have to have a principle which explains absolutely everything. And there's the rationalist in him. We have to have a principle that explains absolutely everything, that leaves nothing out. Okay? And when we do that, we find that this whatever it is cannot be described. It's not one, it's not many, it's not powerful, it's not weak, it's not blue, it's not green, it's not man, it's not non-man, it's not personal, it's not impersonal, it's not eternal, it's not temporal, and so on and so forth. He likes the term one, but he tells us not to take that seriously. That's simply a word which we use because we have to have a name for it. Okay, so the One accounts for everything, but to account for everything, it must have no name. To account for everything, it cannot be characterized. You see what's happening here? We have almost an instantaneous leap from a strong rationalism to an equally strong irrationalism. Okay? An instantaneous leap from rationalism into irrationalism. The rationalism is the idea we have to have an exhaustive explanation of everything. The irrationalism is we have no idea what it is. See, it's funny when you think about it. You know, I've got an explanation for everything. Absolutely exhaustive explanation for everything. You ask me, what is it? I don't know. no idea. I have the foggiest. I can't describe it. Because if I could describe it, it wouldn't be the exhaustive explanation of everything. It's a joke, but it's a joke that's turned into a very elaborate philosophical system, and one which you can study at your leisure. But I think in the final analysis, it reduces to that, and Van Til's distinction between rationalism and irrationalism is indeed very helpful. What Plotinus actually would say, if he were here today, and you say, well, now Plotinus, if this thing has no name and it has no description, then how can you know it? How can you know that it exists? He would say that the only way you can know it is through mystical experience. Okay, mystical experience. Go through a kind of self-discipline. Discipline of the mind, discipline of the body. You reach a point similar to what the medieval mystics described, similar to what the Oriental mystics have described, where you transcend all rational thought and you become one with the ultimate. All right? So just as in Parmenides, everything becomes one. You gain your knowledge by becoming the world, by becoming the other, by becoming the one, by becoming God, if you want to. And that, of course, is one way of answering that question, but what you're doing there is to try to preserve your rationalism through mysticism. Or to put it differently, you preserve your rationalism by an irrationalistic method. You preserve your rationalism by abandoning reason, because essentially that's what the mystic does. The mystic gets to a point where he doesn't need reason anymore. The mystic gets to a point where he is one with God, therefore he doesn't need to know God. He's one with the ultimate, so he doesn't need to know the ultimate. He's one with reality, so he can take his reason and throw it away. Like once you've climbed up to the second story of a house on a ladder, you can throw the ladder away. So that's we're going to see that picture in some modern thinkers, too, a little bit later. But that's Plotinus. I think Plotinus is a very good example of the rationalist-irrationalist dialectic. He shows you in a very short compass how rationalism turns into irrationalism, how the two are really quite inseparable. When you go off on this rationalistic tack of trying to understand everything exhaustively, trying to develop a divine knowledge of the world, inevitably what happens is that you're going to totally abandon your reason at some point. You're going to fall headlong into irrationalism or mysticism, which is essentially the same thing. Okay, let's take another 5-minute break and try to go a little faster through the next section.